Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. If you enjoy our podcasts, please tell your colleagues and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy! Hello, welcome to the podcast. I'm Ian Lewins, paediatric emergency medicine consultant in Derby. And in this pilot episode of this sort of podcast, we've invited a couple of people to come and discuss some papers that they feel fairly relevant at the moment. So there's going to be a discussion with three of us, each bringing a paper to the table. So it's my very great pleasure to firstly introduce Dr. Damien Rowland, who's a paediatric emergency medicine consultant based in Leicester and chair of Perugi. Good afternoon, Damien. How are you?
Hello, hello. I'm doing very well. Thank you for very much for inviting me along.
What have you been up to today, Damien? Anything interesting?
Not really. I've been trying to polish off a few COVID-related papers. Quite an exciting one, actually, about the rate of delayed presentations coming to emergency departments, which I think will get a lot of people thinking. And then other than that, looking forward to going home to relax in the garden.
Excellent. And I'm also joined by Dr. Alistair Munro, who's a clinical fellow in paediatric infectious diseases based in Southampton and now official advisor to the WHO, aren't you, Ali?
I feel like that's perhaps overselling me somewhat. But yes, we've been with the Don't Forget the Bubbles COVID review has been referenced by a WHO document, which is very exciting. Yes,
absolutely. And yes, and you're also now, much like David Hasselhoff, you're huge in Germany.
It was only a matter of time until it happened. And to be honest, I'm surprised it's taken so long. But yes, I have a huge German fan base, apparently. I just wish I could speak enough German to find out why, but someone will probably tell me one day.
So the idea of this is going to be to have three people have a sort of roundtable virtual discussion of three papers, as we said. So Ali's brought a COVID one, Damien's brought a non-COVID one, and I've got a COVID one. So the way we thought we would do this is to have Damien's rose between our two thorns. And we tried to think of a name for this, and Ali's come up with this, and I'm still chuckling, but please forgive me, but it's going to be the three Musker peers. Yes, you heard it right. So, Ali, if we start with your paper, what have you brought for us today?
Okay, so I've brought a fairly controversial paper. This is a paper that came out a few weeks ago from a team in Germany, one of the members of this team is a very prominent virologist in Germany called Christian Drosten, who's acting as one of the lead scientific advisors for the German government during the COVID pandemic. He has his own podcast as well, which I understand is very popular, but it's in German, so I've not listened to it myself. But this study was released as a preprint and was quite explosive, because one of the hot topics at the moment, as the pandemic is tailing off in much of the sort of high-income countries, is about opening lockdown and schools in particular. And children have been a bit of a mystery in the whole COVID saga, because we found so relatively few infections, and it's never been entirely clear whether children have just had such mild disease that there's been millions of them infected and we've never found them, or if they're not getting infected. And then the question is, if they have been infected, how infectious are they? So there's many things that you can do to try and find out how infectious someone is. And one of them is look at how much virus are they carrying, because that is one of the variables that contributes to how likely you might be to pass the infection on. So the premise of this study was essentially from some hospitals in Berlin. They looked at all the samples they'd received, which were positive for SARS-CoV-2, and from the what's called the CT count, which is basically how many runs of PCR they've had to do to find it was positive. Obviously, if you've got lots of virus, you don't need to do many runs to find it's positive. So you can estimate a viral load based on this thing called a CT count from the PCR. So they've tried to estimate the viral loads based on all of the positive swabs they've received at these hospitals in Germany. And then they've tried to find, the study question is, have they found an association of viral load with age? Now, the reason the study became so controversial is it was released preprint, and Drosten tweeted about it, essentially saying, we've shown that children have the same viral loads as adults, meaning they are just as infectious, and therefore we can't recommend that schools all be reopened. And they said as much in the paper, and they went as far as to make a specific comment about how infectious children were and about schools. And obviously this was quite explosive. Very quickly, in fact, on the same day it was released, quite a large number of very senior statisticians took a look at the paper and smelt something a bit whiffy about what had been handled with the data. So I just want to bring up as a really important learning exercise two things about this paper, and then there's a sort of a third interesting thing. But the two really important things for understanding any type of evidence are, whenever you look at a study of tests that have been done on patients, the most important question is who got tested. And without that information in quite good detail, you really can infer almost nothing else from your data. And sadly, from this paper, we have almost no evidence at all about who got tested and when or why. There is a small comment about the children. There were such low numbers of children in the study compared to adults, which is one of the most noticeable things in the figures. They have described that actually only a small proportion of them were tested in a hospital environment, and several of them were in outpatient clinics, but we don't know who was symptomatic, who wasn't, how severe their symptoms were, how long they'd been unwell. And because we know the disease characteristics of children from COVID are so grossly different to those in adults, that comparing any figures or any results, if you don't know at what stage of the illness or what type of presentation you had, it makes it almost impossible to infer anything about the existing viral loads. Because if, you know, all adults who get COVID get sick, then they all get tested. And so you're getting a fairly good population sample of viral loads from, you know, from hospital samples. Whereas if a very small minority of children get sick enough that they ever attend to be tested, then the viral loads you've got from children are just of the children who were most sick, as in they became sick enough that they even bothered getting tested or presented to a hospital. So straight away, we can infer almost nothing from this study because we don't have any of that information. And we don't know if we're comparing suitable groups of children and adults. You know, do we have apples and apples, or do we have apples and pears? So the first problem, and the biggest problem, is epidemiological. Now, the other problem, which has received a bit more attention because it's quite surprising, is a data analysis issue. And it's an issue that becomes apparent if you look at the graphs. So the statement that they found there is no difference between viral loads in children and adults. First of all, you cannot say this based on this type of statistical analysis they've done, because it's standard frequentist statistics, which is all the statistics we're all familiar with, where you get a p-value. Now, you can never rule out a difference with a p-value, because a big p-value cannot tell you there isn't a difference. It can only tell you you did not find one, and it cannot tell you why. You know, if your sample is too small, you have a big p-value. So you have not ruled out there is no difference. So first thing, they cannot say that children and adults have the same viral load. They can say that they didn't find a difference, but they cannot say they're the same. So that's one mistake. Now, the other issue here is if you actually look at the graphs of the mean values of viral loads, there is quite clearly a trend of higher viral loads according to age. Now, the reason that this has not come out in their results is because they've done some fairly unusual statistical methods to try and analyze it, which is age is a continuous variable. So age doesn't strictly have any categories because your age just goes up, you know, every minute, every hour of every day. And so to analyze any trends against age properly, you should treat age as a continuous variable. Now, what they've done is they've put age into categories or bins, as they're sometimes called, and then basically just done lots of comparisons between different bins. Once you do this, you've drastically cut the amount of statistical power you have. And so you're almost certain not to find a difference, even if there is one. Now, interestingly, they did find a difference between the youngest children and the oldest adults, even when they've done this slightly unusual method. But furthermore, they've then done a highly punitive correction for multiplicity. And just to explain what that means, the whole idea of frequentist statistics, or what we understand as traditional medical statistics, is a result tells you, if you repeated an experiment over and over and over again, how many times would you expect to see the result that you have seen, or a more extreme result? Which means that obviously if you do an experiment lots of times or do lots of different tests, by chance, eventually you'll get a small p-value. So they've basically used the method called Bonferroni adjustment, which is the most punitive measure. So if you really don't want to find any significant results, this is a correction that you would employ, which is something else that they've done. So loads of statisticians were up in arms about this, because looking at the graphs, they could quite clearly see that there was a trend, and it was unclear why they've used this method of statistical analysis. Now, a couple of fairly prominent statisticians have since reanalyzed the data. The team won't release the raw data to do a proper analysis, but using the data available in their paper, it's been reanalyzed by Leonard Held, who's a biostatistician. And then just this week, David Spiegelhalter, who's possibly the UK's most eminent statistician, has written a blog post outlining how the data should have been analyzed and showing there is quite clearly, from their data, a trend to increase viral loads according to age, i.e. children have the lowest viral loads and adults have the highest. Now, as I said before, we can't really infer anything from this data because we don't know who they were testing. But what we can certainly say is the conclusions that were published by this group, that there is no difference of viral load according to age, are completely unjustified. And this has attracted a lot of controversy in Germany now, because one of their tabloid newspapers has sort of caught wind of some prominent scientists making comments about these results, and they've put it on their front page that, you know, the study was misleading and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, I think it's made any really reasonable discussion with the authors or from the authors possible, because it's become highly politicized. But then really, that this is the sort of the third thing that I thought was really interesting, is that we'll all be familiar with papers who make really, they oversell their claims, basically. You know, they find this, they find that, and then in the conclusion, there's some wildly over the top recommendation about what this means for clinical practice or whatever. So we are used to seeing that. But this paper made some quite bold statements about what this meant for how infectious children were and what that meant for policy. And it came from an extremely high profile scientist who was acting as a scientific advisor to the government. It's a really interesting interplay here between science and policy and where the two collide. And I don't want to make any statements about right or wrong, because it's obviously, this is a bit of a grey area. We've never lived in such times where science and policy have been so closely interwoven. But I think it just is a really useful example of how careful we must be in tempering our results, and in how we present them, and in how we suggest what we suggest the implications of them are. Because, you know, this has attracted a huge amount of controversy now, and obviously there are groups who are very pro and who are very against different forms of lockdown being lifted, including school opening, and this has just proved sort of a bit of a kicking ball between the two. But I just thought it provided some really useful learning points for interpreting evidence, both in regards to clinical methods of who is involved, and then how important understanding data analysis is, and understanding what a p-value means, and you know, how you can really torture data to make it say whatever you want. You know, if you don't want to find a result, you can make sure that you don't. But you know, equally in the other direction, if you want to run hundreds and hundreds of analyses, you can eventually find a small enough p-value if you need to. So I just thought that it was a really interesting paper for those reasons.
So, Damien, if I bring you in now, you and I are both, you know, big fans of social media and to convey messages. Does what Ali's talked about potentially present some of the dangers here?
Yes, I mean, I love just Ali's enthusiasm for why this is such an important paper to discuss, not just because of the science, but because of the impact it is having elsewhere on the interpretation of science. And you can hear it in his voice that he's really frustrated that the interpretation has not married with the scientific endeavor. And what fascinates me is why people would want to have a certain spin on the outcomes for these type of results. So what is the importance, if you want to show something, of children being as infectious as adults? And that's what's really surprising me. So the social media sphere at the moment is full of lots of hardcore scientists, but it's also full of lots of members of the public, and then lots of people in between trying to come to some sort of opinion and make decisions. And when you have such robust debate and challenge as happened in this paper, it makes it very difficult for people to come to conclusions. But sometimes those conclusions are easier if you can understand the direction of travel. So, for example, if I'm a major pharmaceutical company and I'm trying to promote my drug, it would be obvious that I would try and push the statistical leanings for that paper towards my drug. What I'm surprised about in this paper, and there has been quite a lot of criticism of it, is what is the advantage of children being equal to adults in terms of their infectious rate? What is the policy benefit of pushing that narrative? I wonder if you've got any comments on that, Alistair.
I really think that this is as simple. I mean, this is speculation, obviously. It's pure speculation. But, you know, Christian Drosten is a very well-respected scientist. And I really feel like this is probably just as simple as people involved in this study had probably made up their minds before the study was done what they think. And you can see this in, if you show people data about how in all of these contact tracing studies, children seem so much less likely to acquire the disease than adults, people just cannot get their heads around this because we're so used to thinking of children full of snot, just coughing and sneezing and throwing up and licking things and just, you know, spreading bugs all over the place. And a lot of the this thought comes from flu and other respiratory viruses, which behave relatively similar in that sense, because children are more likely to catch them and spread them, and they act as a reservoir for disease. And I think that some people have just found it so, there's so much cognitive dissonance to imagine that for this respiratory virus, children would be the opposite. And I think that seems so unbelievable that people had decided that, you know, it feels like this group had decided before doing the study that there cannot possibly be a difference. Why would there be a difference? Let's get the data and let's show everyone there isn't a difference. Just to basically back up what they already believed. And we all know we're prone to this. You know, we all have confirmation bias. We all want to go and seek out resources that support what we're already thinking, because to find something that contradicts what you think is really painful. You know, the term cognitive dissonance exists for a reason, because it's so hard to change that. If you feel like something should be a certain way, if you then subsequently produce evidence that it isn't, you know, it's not even necessarily deliberate that you've gone out of your way to try and, you know, massage the data to show it's not. It's just you think, yeah, well, we know this isn't right, so let's make sure, oh, it's probably just multiplicity. Let's correct for that. Yeah, we'll do this and we'll do that. And, you know, I think everyone is guilty of that to some extent, but this has played out, you know, in an international sort of way, you know, in an arena where there's so much intense interest on it that it's then become more than just, you know, people's people just confirming their own beliefs. It's become a, you know, a highly political and highly charged debate. That that's the impression I get. You know, I don't know how much merit there is to that, but that's what it feels like to me.
It's a bit like you going on about how you have to have a bag urine because it's the only way to catch clean urine samples, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, if anyone ever tried to present data to me saying that it was totally acceptable to use a urine bag to collect a sample for MCNS, I would do everything in my power to refute those findings. I would do every possible statistical adjustment to show it wasn't. But yeah.
I'm going to work on that paper now, just to spite.
Yes.
Because I guess, as you say, Alec, you know, the idea at the start of when this all kind of was coming was, well, kids are not going to be affected as much, but they're going to be these super spreaders. And that's just not seemed to be the case.
No, I mean, we just haven't found any evidence for that at all. But that was certainly the concern. And I think, you know, as the stories evolved, certainly the first contact tracing study that came out of Shenzhen appeared to suggest that that was the case. You know, there were slightly lower rates of slightly lower attack rate in children than adults, but not statistically significant. But the children did appear in that study much more likely to be asymptomatic. And so it seemed like, you know, children must be just as affected, must just be just as infected, but just not displaying symptoms. And oh my gosh, if they're all out there and they don't have symptoms, they must be giving it to everybody. But yeah, I mean, the evidence is really sort of trickling in on this front, but it's all been fairly, fairly consistent. You know, we're just finding lower rates of community infection in children, and certainly nowhere have we found any more in children than in adults.
And one question that sort of I'd got as a very simpleton is, when you look at viral load, how much does that sort of equate to infectivity, and does it equate at all with the sort of clinical picture that you see in these children? Do we know?
Well, that's been really hard to ascertain for COVID, because there's two issues. So one is that viral load, as measured by this method, which is the CT value for RT-PCR, isn't telling you how much live virus is there. So for example, if you test stool or do anal swabs, you'll find heaps of quote-unquote virus. But then if you try and inoculate that into cells to grow virus, only rarely have we ever, I think there's only a couple of studies that have ever found live virus. So what we know is that if you can find lots and lots and lots of viral RNA, which is what you're actually measuring, that doesn't always equate to live virus. And there's just not good enough data yet to show that. I think there's one small preprint that's only of about 20 children trying to look at that, which isn't really enough to give us much of an answer. So live virus is really what we're interested in, rather than just viral load as measured by RT-PCR. But then there's so many other things, because there's so much we don't understand about transmission of this virus yet. So certainly viral load is probably an important thing, because if you've not barely got any virus, you're less likely to pass it on. Whereas if you're just hosing it out, it will be easier to shed it and spread it. But you know, the other surprising thing about this virus has been that it appears a lot of transmission happens pre-symptomatically, whereas, you know, previously we've always correlated how infectious you are with your symptoms, because clearly if you're, you know, leaking loads of snot and coughing over everybody, then you're more likely to spread it. But it looks like, you know, and again, the data isn't excellent, but it looks like probably quite a bit of transmission happens in a day or so before you develop symptoms. And that seems to correlate with viral load in adults. And we just don't have the data in children at all. And part of the reason is, as we've said before, the numbers are so small. And it's just not been a massive research priority to find out, because we haven't really found the evidence that children have been that involved in spreading it. It would certainly be useful to know. I imagine that it's going to be difficult to study now, because the rates of active infection in the community are now quite low. But yeah, trying to ascertain what exactly the viral loads are in children who are symptomatic and asymptomatic, and then how infectious they may or may not be, is an interesting question.
Yeah. Damien, just, you know, with your Peruki hat on, is this a good time to be involved in research, or is this a really difficult time to be involved in research? Because there is so much now coming out that's under such scrutiny, which is going to be of such variable quality potentially.
Yeah, that's a really insightful question. So if you have the capacity to rapidly reform the research that you're doing into something that is directly related to COVID, these are exciting times, because I think the opportunities are there to really make a difference to processes and procedures that are already happening. But if your research isn't particularly related to COVID, i.e. health impacts, or that the population, kind of if you're not an intensive care researcher and you're more interested in something that is a bit more, I'm trying to think of a good example that isn't affected in any way from COVID, and I'm struggling a bit, but the primary stuff, all the money's going to the primary big studies about how we stop COVID in hospitals, and maybe starting to think about the community now. So that's really cool. What I think is happening, Alistair and I are just about to kind of publish on this, is what we're not doing is thinking about the wider consequences of illness. So exciting research to look at the COVID virus itself. I'm not disputing it's not important to have a vaccine, but there's a tried and tested methodology for doing that, which is going on. But the collateral damage, this word that is often bandied around about, so how are health services being impacted by the fact that clinics aren't occurring, or the fact that we've moved staff around, or they're not able to offer what they used to be, are annual reviews occurring, all these things, that's much more difficult to measure. And especially if you're a paediatrician, I think there's lots of paediatricians out there feeling pretty uncomfortable at the moment because they're not seeing the patient groups that they used to. Now, that's brilliant for some diseases, but not so great for some of these chronic diseases. And trying to push that research forward in the current climate is quite challenging. And I think it's something that we really need to look at. Massively exciting times for kind of knowledge translation, though. So social media can be a blessing and a curse. And clearly there's a bit of negativity, and Alice has described sometimes study results are misinterpreted. But there's lots of people engaged at the moment in terms of health policy, in terms of interested about the impact of doing certain things. And I think while some of that's political and unfortunate, some of it will make people think a lot more about their own impact, one in their own department, about what their department's doing in this, but also the wider impact of health on the wider impact of socioeconomic status on health, and how health outcomes are quite important and linked to so much of what we do in our daily lives. So it's a bit chalk and cheese, but brilliant possibility, great learning for the wider clinical bodies. But I do think we need to pay a bit more attention to some unintended consequences.
Absolutely. So, Alistair, just back to you then. What's the name of the paper, and where is it published?
Well, it's a preprint paper, and I think that I don't have it up in front of me. I think the title is just Association of Viral Load with Age. The first author surname is Jones, and it's Christian Drusten is the professor whose group it's from in Berlin.
Okay, so that's Ali's paper. Damien, what have you got for us?
Well, I was just recently teaching on the Don't Forget the Bubbles Essentials course, and there was quite a bit of discussion about head injuries and the management of head injury. And there was a paper literally released at the end of April. It's from a Dutch group, and the paper's entitled Application of PCARN Rules with Significantly Decreased CT Rates in a Dutch Cohort of Children with Minor Traumatic Head Injury. And there's just two things I really wanted to bring out. So this is essentially a paper that looks at comparing the Dutch guidance on managing minor head injury in children with the PCARN rules. Now, PCARN are a research network. They're in the United States. Please do look up the PCARN CT rules. It's a really nice way of classifying a decision. And it's about who you don't need to CT. It's a different frame of the way that we're used to in head injuries. But the essential thing was that the Americans were scanning too many children and they wanted to reduce that. And I think the Dutch group were thinking the same. And there's this amazing kind of quote in the first sentence. In the Netherlands, the 2010 national guidelines were resulting in an overall CT scan rate of 44%. And I thought, wow, that's just massive. So I went to look at that particular paper. And this is again, it's from the same study group. It's looking at minor head injury. So these aren't children with ridiculously low GCSs. I think the GCS was 13 to 15 and maybe a suspicion of some form of fracture. And the overall CT rate in 1,000 patients was 44%. And I thought that just seems huge, way outside my kind of particular practice specifications. Maybe I'm not CTing enough. But the original paper was a planned study. They'd enrolled 1,000 children younger than 18 with a kind of an a priori definition of minor head injury being GCS of 13 to 15 with no more than a couple of hours of potentially kind of reduced conscious level or amnesia. And what they found is that if they applied the PECAN guidance rather than the Dutch national guidance, you'd essentially go from about 60% of scans being indicated to around 23%. But with no real change in the pickup rate of serious disease. The interesting thing about the paper was that although there were lots of positive CTs, there was nothing in there that was a clinically important traumatic brain injury, i.e. something that needed to go urgently to a neurosurgical center. So I think their population wasn't potentially the same as some of the populations that I'm used to seeing locally, where we do every so often have to send a child to our local neurosurgical center. But again, it just demonstrates to me how important the implementing guidance is that's relevant to your own setting. And clearly, whatever guidance they'd done before was allowing a very different level of risk. And putting in the PECAN guidance has completely changed the ability to not CT without actually missing any patients. And there must be so much we have in kind of pediatric practice at the moment, whereas if we really reviewed what we did, I suspect we could get more value with less risk for the patient. And I just thought this was a really good example of that.
So having sort of looked at that, is this something that would change your practice, or does it sort of reaffirm that, in your view, you're probably doing the right thing already?
So the only thing it reaffirms my practice. I wonder still if we've got the NICE head injury guidance right, and I'm just desperate for them to remove vomiting as a real issue at all, because I think that's been really proven now that isolated vomiting alone doesn't really matter how much you vomit. If you've got no other concerns, you don't need a CT scan, and I would love to see that come into the NICE guidance.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I'm sure you know all of us have worked in ED, know multiple kids who have a very minor trauma and then frequently come back the next day, you know, vomiting, and the whole house is vomiting, and you're left with this dilemma of, well, I'm fairly certain that the vomiting is zero to do with the head injury, but it sits there in the NICE guidance of, you know, you've vomited three times, then you've vomited some more, so do I scan or not?
Yeah, I'd be really interested to hear your experience as well, you guys, whether you think those children actually do end up normally getting a scan or not.
I think
not when I'm on shift.
No, exactly. Who's on shift? And I think the majority of these kids, in my experience, don't. They don't. But that's why, you know, you have to sort of say these are guidelines. These are not hard and fast, set in stone. And generally, I wouldn't scan these kids at all.
I can think of a few that I've had when I've been in peripheral hospitals and I've discussed it with a consultant. And the good thing is, obviously, if you're in a smaller hospital, getting a CT scan in a child out of hours is quite difficult. And so there's just that little extra bit of resistance that perhaps help you decide whether it's really worth doing for, you know, the kid who's just been sick a few times.
Yeah, definitely. I think the ease of CT is a real danger to things. And I'd also say that it's often our experience, because we're a teaching site, of when the adult trainees come to us to learn paediatric practice, you can see their practice changing as they learn that the natural history of these children are just to get better. But if you've not seen that before, you are quite reliant on the guidance. And if the guidance says four vomits and you're out, then you'll follow that, because that's what we do in clinical practice.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I guess the next interesting bit would be if you got rid of vomiting from the NICE guidance and then went back and audited or had a look at these kids with clinically significant, how many you'd miss. And I guess that will happen at some point in the future.
Yeah, no, I very much hope so. But the next step then is to really look at what else we can start shaving off, because I'm sure there are other things that we could do. And definitely, I think it was also the PCARM group showed that ultimately, if you really go back to basics and ignore the algorithm completely and just ask a senior kind of consultant whether they think the CT scan is indicated or not, actually, that decision is usually right from the outset.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's sort of your, yeah, that's experience. And the problem is, of course, that you can't teach experience very easily, can you? And for the poor SHO or registrar who's stuck there overnight, who maybe hasn't got access to a consultant, they're going to scan, aren't they?
Yeah, almost certainly. And that probably is the safest thing to do on a population level.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Damien. I daren't ask, do you give ondansetron for your vomiting kids with head injuries? Because that's an entirely different debate.
You've grabbed the nettle there.
I think. Well, we should. Let's bring that back to another one of these discussions to have that on its own. I'll find a paper relevant to that, and we can have that discussion out in the open.
Yeah, I like that. We'll just very quickly move on to mine, because I'm very conscious of time. Mine is essentially a big advert for my new employers, which is the BMJ Paediatrics Open, and this has been published just this week. And this is a paper coming from Blackpool, from Maurice Gordon and his team. And it's a rapid systemic review, a systematic review, I should say, of neonatal COVID, including a case of presumed vertical transmission, which they discuss. And I think the thing that's sort of interesting about this, the thing that struck me about this, was how rapid they did this. So they looked at all the literature from the 1st of December 2019 to the 12th of May of this year to try and get case reports and studies and those sorts of things. They revised it on the 13th of May. It was accepted on the 16th of May and then published, I think, on the 25th of May. So that's pretty damn rapid. It takes me that long to organise the sort of apps on my screen on my phone. So these guys are not messing around. And really, what's known about this subject? Well, the bottom line is we know that COVID-19 has been described globally in children and adults of all ages, but very few cases have been reported in neonates and preterm babies. So what they did was that they looked at all the studies that they could find to try and sort of whittle it down. And in the end, they found only 10 published cases of COVID in neonates, as well as the case that they report. And the case that they report is interesting, of a lady who's come in known to be COVID positive on nasal swab. The entire team are in full PPE. Baby's delivered prematurely and ultimately ends up getting intubated, I think, but then makes a pretty rapid recovery and is well, whereas mum becomes really quite unwell and ends up intubated and then tracheostomy on ITU. But what they've found is that I think a total of 3 cases of presumed vertical transmission, because I guess at the outset of this, that the big worry was, do we get vertical transmission of COVID from pregnant mums who are positive to neonates, and how is it going to affect them? And the short answer seems to be, well, generally speaking, the neonates are fairly cope pretty well. And in the other cases that are reported, actually, they were pretty much asymptomatic. So looks like that, and they say that the key to their future research considers the possibility of transmission from asymptomatic mothers. And I guess this is the thing that at this stage we don't know. And I don't know if units are screening every single lady for COVID. Do you know in your units, guys, what they're doing?
It changes on an almost daily basis.
Yeah. Damien, do you know what Leicester are doing?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't actually. But like Alistair, I'm sure that this is something that has waxed and waned over time.
Yeah. So it's interesting in the case that they report that the initial PCR swab on day one of life was negative, but then the child had positive swabs on day 14, and day 21. Whilst at that point was entirely asymptomatic. So it obviously has quite significant implications for the unit as a whole and the nursing team and who's going to nurse these kids. And interestingly, the child goes home with mum, who's made a recovery on day 33 of life, but still positive on swabs at day 28. Yeah, so interesting. It does happen in neonates, but it seems to be, thankfully, vertical transmission, whilst it does happen, seems to be incredibly rare. And I don't know if that's sort of in keeping with what you're recognising from the research that you've been looking at, Ali.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So the other paper that's looked at this in some detail is a data from the Nuffield Population Science Group in Oxford. And they don't have as much clinical neonatal data because it's mainly maternity data, but they've looked at over 400 pregnant women who contracted COVID, of which about 240 something delivered during the study period, and the rest of them are have ongoing pregnancies, which is obviously probably good news because they weren't due to labour yet. And I think there were 12 cases of neonatal COVID reported from those 240-something births, which is not a completely negligible risk, but is a fairly small risk. Again, there's no sort of detailed reports on the clinical outcomes of the babies. But what is interesting is that of those 12, six of them tested positive within 12 hours after delivery. Now that would imply perinatal transmission at the very least, if not vertical transmission. What's not clear, I guess, still is whether there's intrauterine infection or whether there's infection during delivery, which I don't think would be a massive surprise to anyone. But given that I don't think we've managed to find many secretions, test positive, so vaginal secretions and amniotic fluid and everything have all tested negative so far. It is interesting. So yeah, I suppose that's consistent. It's a small but not completely negligible risk, but it does appear from everything we've seen so far that even neonates don't appear to get desperately sick when they're infected.
Yeah, and it's, I think the other interesting bit about this paper, looking at the data that they've collected, is that of the cases they report, actually, I think there's three at least are all are preterms as opposed to term babies. And the question is, I guess, is that coincidental, or is there something about COVID-19 that is causing premature birth? And I guess that's going to be very, very difficult to, if at all possible, to tease out.
Yeah, I mean, again, the Nuffield population data is quite good for this because the numbers are quite small, really, of preterm labour, but it does definitely. So they've got a matched cohort group in this study, taken from another year, which was obviously pre-COVID pandemic, and there is definitely an increased risk of premature labour for these pregnant women who become unwell. I don't think that should be a surprise to anybody because we know that almost any acute illness at all in pregnancy would make you more likely to go into preterm labour because that is how the body responds to a febrile illness in pregnancy. So it doesn't look like COVID is any more severe in pregnant women than it is in anyone else in the population per se. But obviously, like, you know, if a pregnant lady were to get a bad case of the flu, similarly, you might expect an increased risk of preterm labor for the same reasons. Just that's how the body responds to a febrile illness in pregnancy.
So there we go. That's the first pilot episode then of the Three Musketeers. Yeah, I think we're going to stick with that name. That's on you, Ali.
I take no responsibility for that name.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell our listeners what the other name you came up with because it was totally unbroadcastable. But thank you both for joining me today. We must do it again some other time. And I hope you join us again soon. And thanks very much for listening. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. Remember, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.